Good to be with you again this glorious Sunday morning to gather in God's house with God's people. If you're visiting with us, I'm really glad you're here. Love to make space for you to come and explore who Jesus is, what his church is. Midtown doesn't promise to have all the answers for you, but we can promise to show you who Jesus says he is. So, which is not a bad segue into where we're going to be today in the next couple weeks. Today we begin a little mini-series. Now, we're not preaching a new website series, but some of the language on the new website is guiding this little mini-vision series for the next several weeks, where here's what we're just going to be doing. Midtown Fellowship Church, the one church that we all are as we share these six kind of sister congregations, this family of churches, is in its 25th year. And so it's reason to celebrate what the Lord has done, and you maybe been here forever and didn't even know that. You maybe knew and had no idea that we're kind of this one thing in this city. And here's what the new website and what this series is going to introduce to you or reintroduce to you is who Midtown has always been and what we've always been about. So if you're curious about this place and what we believe and kind of how we believe it and why we believe it, this is a great series to get to know us. But all that it is some language that you'll see on the new website. It's just a simplifying and a recapitulating of what our vision and mission has really always been, what we've always been about. And so it's three little phrases that we're going to cover for the next couple weeks, and they are as follows: to let in, to be with, and to go out. So today we're going to begin with let in, and what does that mean? To let Jesus in, to let him love you, to submit to his love for you. What does that mean? And I'm not only talking to non-Christians in the room, which I'm really glad you're here, but I'm also talking to Christians in the room who have forgotten what God's love is, who maybe even as recently as last night forgot what God's love for them is like. And so wherever you are on your spiritual journey, would you dare to again and again and again submit to his love for you? Would you let him in? That's what we're going to do today. We're going to do that in a really interesting story in the New Testament. It comes from the book of Acts. Acts is short for Acts of the Apostles or Acts of the Early Church. What were they doing after Jesus ascended into heaven? And so the book of Acts covers a lot of the life of the early church. And the main character in that is a guy named Paul, who encounters Jesus on the road to Damascus, the resurrected Jesus. He encounters him, and then he can't stop telling people about this resurrected rabbi that he met on the way to Damascus. He was headed to kill Christians, and then he becomes one. So he goes all over the known world, all over the Mediterranean, and all over the Roman Empire to plant churches and to tell people about Jesus. We find him in the book of Acts in the city of Athens, the global city of Athens, which we'll say a little bit more about in a minute. And he's there to meet some other apostles and other church planters there. But while he's waiting on them, he goes into the city to tell others about this resurrection of Jesus that he's encountered just recently. So this is from Acts chapter 17. It's a really notorious chapter, critical chapter in Paul's missionary journeys. And he finds himself in Athens. We're going to begin in verse 16. And we're just going to read 16 verses of this story, 16 through 32. So here we go. The word of the Lord. Now, while Paul was waiting for them in Athens, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him, and some said, "What does this babbler wish to say?" So people said to me. Others said, "He seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities," because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? For you bring some strange things to our ears. We wish to know, therefore, what these things mean." Now all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing except telling or hearing something new. Verse 22, so Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription, 'To the unknown God.'" We'll talk about that in a minute. "What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you, the God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods in the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him. Yet, he is actually not far from each one of us. For, quote, in him we live and move and have our being. That's from the Old Testament. And now, and even as some of your own poets have said, he's quoting from their poetry, for we are indeed his offspring. We'll talk about that too. Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and the imagination of man. The times of ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, because he has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed. That's Jesus. And of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. It's the word of the Lord. Amen. Okay. Paul's in Athens, this global city of Athens. Rome had become the power center of the known world, but Athens in Greece remained the cultural epicenter, the intellectual epicenter of the world. And Paul, we're told in verse 17, goes to the marketplace. Well, what was the marketplace where he goes to begin his teaching? The marketplace, we don't have anything like it. It's kind of like, just go with me for a second, if Broadway and the 12 South Strip and the Vandy and Belmont quads and the Frist and the Skirmahorn and the Ryman were all in the same place. Like, we don't have anything like it, but it was their everything. In the marketplace were temples, law courts, state offices, public archives, libraries, shops, concert halls, dance halls, gymnasiums, theaters, and art galleries. It was the marketplace for everything. It was a marketplace of ideas. It's where philosophers went to share. It's the marketplace of philosophy, the marketplace of business, the marketplace of art. So who is in the marketplace when Paul goes there? Everybody. It is the center of the cultural capital of the world, is the marketplace in Athens. Athens has an unrivaled reputation as the intellectual metropolis of the known world, Alexandria down in Egypt too, and Rome some, but if you wanted to be somebody in the cultural imagination sense or in the philosophical sense or in the art sense or in the intellectual sense, you went to Athens. Athens is where Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle all taught, in this marketplace. It's where they taught and philosophizers, and they shared their ideas and changed the world in this marketplace in Athens. Paul goes there. And he goes to Athens, in the marketplace in Athens, and he begins teaching about the resurrection. Guys, I gotta tell you about this. I know you have all these gods. I gotta tell you about this resurrected rabbi that I met on the road to Damascus. He's not dead, he's alive. He's a real human. I met him. And before he goes there to really share, and before he unpacks all that he wants to share, we're told something that Paul noticed about the city that framed what he wanted to share. It's Paul's understanding of what he sees, and it frames how he's going to go about sharing with them what he wants to share with them about Jesus. Look at what Paul notices in our first verse, verse 16. What does he first notice? Now, while Paul was waiting for them, that's his friends, to get there at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols. What's an idol? An idol was an ancient world carving of gold or marble or bronze or silver. It was an elegant carving that was the manifestation, they believed, of one of their gods. So that god lives in that temple, and to represent the being that we are bowing down to and sacrificing to and praying to, let's carve an image that we think looks like that god so that we can go bow before that god in that god's temple or in that god's shrine. They were everywhere in Athens. And so you hear what Paul notices, which is, I see that he saw that the city was full of idols. And you may go, okay, well, of course, Paul, there's a pantheon of Greek gods. There's hundreds of Greek gods. Big deal that you notice that there were statues to gods everywhere. It's been said before of ancient Athens, it's easier to find a god in Athens than a man. Like there were statues to gods and to goddesses everywhere. The infamous Parthenon, which we have the only replica in the world of over at Centennial, in the middle of the Parthenon, which stood on the highest point of the hill above the city, kind of looking down the city, was a giant statue to Athena. We also have that. And in that statue of Athena, it was said of her that her spear, the tip of her golden spear that she was holding, was visible from 40 miles away. Like literally the entire city was in the shadow of the gods. And it was very evident that like, oh, this town and this culture and these people and this time in history is worshiping these gods that are everywhere. And everywhere Paul looks, he sees a god. But he's not just trying to tell them the obvious. It's not just, thank you, Captain Obvious Paul, that you noticed that there were statues to these gods everywhere. When it says that Paul noticed that the city was full of idols, that's not the word full of like, the water, that cup is full of water. It's like to the brim. Kind of. It's more this word. This Greek verb that we translate full of is more this word. The city was completely submerged in idols. Meaning this, the city was suffocating in its idols. It was like being oppressed. It was like pressing down and not letting them breathe. That's what it means to be full of idols that Paul sees. Hey, city of Athens, Paul is noticing, you're drowning in idols and you don't even know it. You are swamped with idols and you can't even breathe. So Paul takes that framework and he goes to the marketplace to teach about the resurrection, knowing that they're drowning in idols and they can't see it. And the people who hear his first words about this resurrected Jesus are like, what is this babbler talking about? We've never heard about this. But they're so intrigued by it, we're told he then gets dragged up to the Areopagus, which was, so Athena's Parthenon was at the highest point in the city. Just underneath that, another hill that overlooked the city of Athens was the Areopagus, also known as Mars Hill. It's popularly how it's called. Mars Hill, Mars is the Roman name of the Greek god Ares, who is the god of war. But Mars Hill was, it's in Greek mythology, that hill was where Ares, the Areopagus, was where Mars, Ares, was put on trial. So it was a very important hill for very important conversations historically and mythologically that they would say, this guy's here telling us something we've never heard before, this new philosophy, this new religion, this new resurrection thing he's talking about. Let's take him up where the real conversations happen. Let's bring our best philosophers, let's bring our best listeners and our best scholars up there, and let's let them debate with Paul in the most important debate hall, Mars Hill, in the whole city. So he's literally looking down on the city. He has the audience of the cultural epicenter of the world listening to him. And this is what he wants to tell them first. Verse 22. So Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. And you may go, man, Paul, you had a great shot to like catch their attention. Your first line, you want to tell them that you notice that they're very religious? And he would say, yeah, that's exactly what I needed them to know. Because Paul doesn't just want to expose their religiosity. He's trying to lead them somewhere, but he starts by trying to convince them, do you know how religious you are? Do you know that there's these gods everywhere, and do you know how religious that has made you? I perceive that in every way you are very religious. Why would he start there? Well, let's talk about this. What does it mean to be religious? What is a religion? Well, here's what's true about every religion in the history of ever. Every religion requires for you, if you want to be a part of that religion, to worship something and to sacrifice to it. Now, that worship and that sacrifice can look different, but every religion in the history of the world requires that you worship something and that you sacrifice to it. Every religion requires that of you. So why is Paul starting there? I note that the whole city is drowning in idols, a world full of idols. You're submerged in it. But let me start you over here by telling you, do you know how religious you are? Do you know that you're worshiping and sacrificing? Your very worldview and framework is one of religiosity. Do you know that? So what would connect those dots? Why does Paul want them to know you're drowning in idols and that makes you very religious? What would cause the people of Athens to worship and sacrifice to these gods that have these temples everywhere? It's this. Do you know that every god has a gospel? Gospel is just a term that means good news. Do you know that every god makes promises to you? Do you know that every god promises you something, and that every god promises that if you do what they require, if you worship them and sacrifice to them, then you will get something from them? Every god has a gospel, and you get that gospel announcement from them when you worship and sacrifice to them. And so no matter what you worship, or what you're religious about, you are looking for the god that you're worshiping to give you something in return. And you may go, hey, hold the phone, dude. I don't have statues in my house. Like, I don't see shrines. Like, no one's been to Athena in the Parthenon to worship it in a very long time, I don't think. So, like, what are we talking about? Well, if every god has a gospel and we don't have these little statues around our city, do you know that our city is actually full of gods? Our city is full of idols. Do you know that we worship and sacrifice to all kinds of things? So whether you worship money or fame, or whether you worship romantic relationships, or whether you worship status, or whatever it is that you worship, whether you worship fitness and looking a certain way, whatever it is that you worship, do you know that your worship and your sacrifice to that thing has promised you something in return that you will get from it if you do the right things before it? Every god has a gospel. And broadly speaking, every god's gospel typically covers three categories. Broadly speaking, every idol we worship promises us these three things. Every god we worship, we're looking for these three things to deliver on. Every idol we worship promises to make us, to sustain us, and to make us belong. Every idol we worship promises to make us, sustain us, and make us belong. So a couple examples. Every idol promises to make us. For instance, if I've made an idol out of money, if I worship and sacrifice to the god of money, that doesn't just mean I want my bank account to look a certain way. I do, hypothetically. But what I actually want if I'm worshiping the god of money is this. I want that god of money to tell me who I am. I want an identity as someone who has made a lot of money and has the security of having a lot of money. So I need the idol of money. The more I can get from it, the more I can add zeros to my bank account. That will finally make me feel secure and like I have arrived, so that that idol now has given me an identity that is secure. I don't just want to make money. I want money to make me. I need my idol to make me. Now, you can do that with anything. You can do it with your marriage. I need my marriage to be a certain way and to feel a certain way and to always have the bliss that I know it can have. And so I will work and sacrifice and worship the idea, the idol of a perfect marriage, because I need that idol of, once I've arrived at having the perfect marriage, then I'll know who I am. That idol will have made me who I am. You can do it with a job. You can do it with an achievement. You can do it with getting into a school. You can do it with anything. I need this idol to tell me who I am, to make me. That's one thing we want our idols to do. Second thing we want our idols to do is we want our idols to sustain us. So if I make an idol out of fame, which is an easy one in this town, or maybe like the less offensive version of wanting to be famous that we can all maybe admit to is, I don't need to be famous. That maybe is a nightmare. I just want everyone to like me. I want people to think well of me. I want to have the reputation as someone who doesn't have any tiffs with anybody. And so I have an idol of, I need everyone to think a certain way about me. So if I want that identity, if I need that, if I need to be liked, I don't just want that idol to give me that identity to make me, I need it to sustain me. And here's what that means. When I'm having the dark night of the soul and I can't sleep, or I'm anxious or afraid about something, or I feel insecure about something, here's what I'll do. I'll look to the idol of my reputation and go, okay, at least I have that. Take care of me, idol, when I feel like I'm losing other things. I'll come back to you, and I'll worship and sacrifice to you, and I'll kill myself in the process of having a reputation that goes a certain way, so that when I feel insecure and when I feel anxious, I can come back to you, and you'll love me, and you'll take care of me. Idol, take care of me when I need you most. Sustain me. Don't leave me. Give me purpose when I'm despairing. Give me comfort when I'm hurting. Yeah, I want people to like me. Really what I want is that enough of those people will finally be able to take care of me. The reputation of that will finally be able to take care of me when I need it. So we need our idols to make us. We need our idols to sustain us. And we need our idols to make us feel like we belong. So this can look a lot of different ways. But like, if I'm successful enough, driven enough, put enough letters after my name with enough degrees, if I sign the right deals, if I do the right things, if I get righteous enough or trained enough or disciplined enough, if I do enough things, maybe, then maybe, I will feel like I have a place to belong. Like I will achieve my way into being welcomed into a community. I will earn my way into being loved in return so that I don't ever feel alone or lonely. And I don't care what kind of house you grew up in, if it was functional or dysfunctional, I don't know what your relationship is like with your family of origin at home, it could be great or it could have been hell. Here's what I know that everyone in the room, this is real for. Everyone in here wants to know that there's a family and a father that would welcome us in. Everyone in here wants to know that there's a family and a father that would take us in and take us back. Everyone. So idol, give me a place to call home. I have this longing to belong to a family. I have this longing to belong to a place. I have this longing to belong to a community. Maybe I can prove to enough people that I'm rich enough or smart enough or intellectual enough or savvy enough or emotionally healthy enough or whatever it is that you think will earn you a place to belong. We're all looking for it. Idol, make me feel like I belong somewhere. Idol, make me feel like I'm welcome somewhere. That's what all of our idols promise us. If you worship me and sacrifice to me, if you come and bow down at my altar, I will make you, I will sustain you, and I will make you feel like you belong. All of our idols are promising that. That's what all idols' gospels sound like. Make me, sustain me, make me belong. And so when we worship idols like that, when we worship idols that promise us those kinds of things, guess what then happens to us? Like, what does our functional day-to-day living look like when we're bowing down to the altar of one of these idols, one of these gods? Men and women of Nashville, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. These Athenians and us are so alike. You may not know it, but with our Parthenon, with Athena in there, and with our love of the arts and our love of music and our love of cultural things and our love of the university presence here, do you know this? Do you know that Nashville is dubbed the Athens of the South? Athens, Georgia has a problem with that, but we have been dubbed the Athens of the South. We are just like the Athens of old. Now, we may not have just as many idols as they did, like in terms of statues up, but in every way, we are very religious. But here's where it gets tricky. It's so subtle here, because did you know, we're the Athens of the South. Did you know on this side, the thing that's also true is that, I'm not making this up, per capita, we have more people in this city than anywhere else in the country that would identify this way when talking about their religious and spiritual life. They would say, I identify as spiritual but not religious. We have more people than anywhere in the country that identify that way. So we have this town that's drowning in idols. We're like Athens of old. We have all kinds of gods we worship. But I'm really spiritual, but I'm not religious. And so there's a disconnect there where people will go, well, yeah, I love spiritual things. I love talking about spiritual things. I love talking about emotional things. I love talking about spirituality, but don't put a label on me. Don't put a religion on it. I'm not religious. I'm just spiritual. And if Paul were walking around this city, do you know what he would say? Men and women of Nashville, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. Like, I know that you're spiritual and not religious, but do you know when you have a God, you are religious? Do you know if you worship anything, if you bow down to anything, if you sacrifice to anything, that thing has become your God that has promised you things in return, and you become very religious? Now, it may not look like you're going to a church service or a Bible study or doing religious practices, but you are doing religious things with the God that you are worshiping. There are all kinds of gods in this city. There are all kinds of gods that promise us things to make us, sustain us, and make us belong. And in response to those promises, we worship them and we sacrifice to them. So I started thinking about, like, there's so many easy ones, like success or money or fame or sex. Like, there's so many things that are kind of the big categorical idols of a people. But I started thinking about some other idols in our town. How about this one? How about this God? How about the God of being relevant? Like this, like, I kind of need people to be talking about me when I'm not there, and I need them to be talking about me in the right way. I need to always be on the right side of all the social issues so that when I'm brought up, at least people know what side I'm on. I need to be aware of all the current fads, all the current trends, all the current conversations, which means if I'm going to do that, I have to listen to all the right podcasts and watch all the viral reels so that I'm not in some conversation where people say, well, have you listened to this podcast yet? And I'm like, oh, yeah, I was just doing that. Like, I can never be forgotten, and so if I need to be relevant, then I have to be up to date with everything, with all the new bands, with all the new venues, with all the new coffee shops, with all the new places, with all the new restaurants, with all the new whatever. I can't be forgotten, so I have to stay relevant to be a part of the conversation that everybody's having. So I will bow down and sacrifice and worship the idea of being relevant and being in the right places, and I'll lose myself in the process. Do you know what the tagline is like the motto is of the God and the religion of being relevant? What have you done for me lately? In this town, that's everybody's favorite phrase that nobody says. Because here's how that looks. Like maybe you had a great tour last year and it sold out, but what have you done like recently? Like, like you had a bunch of streams last year, but what about right now? Or like, I know you landed that business deal last year and you like developed that part on the East Bank, but like, have you done anything else? Like, I know your school was good last year, but like, what about now? What have you done like 10 seconds ago? Like, have you done anything? Do you have any worth? Like, I know what grade you made as a junior at Vanderbilt, but what about senior year? Like, what have you done now? That one stung my wife when I said that last service because she's a alum. But that was anchored down, by the way, Vandy. But like that tagline of what have you done lately? Everybody is swimming in that. I don't care what you've done. What are you doing right now? Do you think anybody in this town sacrifices to the God of being relevant? Or how about the God of kind of the nephew of that God of being relevant? How about the God of I'll never be a nobody? I'll prove to my dad or my high school friends that didn't think or my ex, or I'll prove to somebody that has become my audience that I will be a somebody. I will not be a nobody in this town. Do you know that nobody moved here to lead a quiet life? Nobody came here to go, I'd like just to meditate. Like no one does that. You moved here to be somebody in some field, at something. How about the God of being in the inner circle? How many of you have ever felt you're in a community, you're at a school, you're in an industry, you're with a label, you're at a church, and you feel like, man, when I'm there, I feel like there's this inner circle and I'm on the outside of it. And if I'm gonna be made, sustained, and feel like I belong, I gotta get on the inside of the circle. Everybody feels like they're outside of the circle, everybody. So we worship the God of getting into the inner circle. So many gods in this city. Those are just three. It took me like 10 minutes to come up with those, because I listen to my friends when they talk about their gods. So many gods in the city that Paul would maybe say it's easier to find a god in this city than a person. And here's what Paul was begging them to admit and begging us to admit. That life's too short to pretend you're not religious. Do not live with your head in the sand to imagine that you're just spiritual but not religious. The moment you become spiritual, which is everybody, you are religious. Because you have a God that has promised you something, and in return to that, you're becoming religious with that God. Life's too short to pretend like you don't have idols and that those idols promise you things that you sacrifice and worship for. Started reading a new book this week. It's got a great title. I'm only a couple chapters in. It's called Don't Forget We're Here Forever. It's a great title. It's by this British journalist. Her name's Lamorna Ash, and it is raw and really well written, and it's honest. And she's this writer in the UK, and she decided about 3 or 4 years ago that she saw an uptick in the UK in a rise in Christianity. Like churches were adding people to them, and she was flabbergasted. Like, why in the world would anybody go to that ancient religion called Christianity? It makes no sense. But she had two friends that converted, and she was like, I have to check this out. So this book is her kind of journal of trying Christianity out for 2 years and seeing what she learned. It's really good. But this is what she says in the intro, kind of what she was feeling and what all of her friends feel, even though they would all say we're spiritual but not religious. But here's what here's what she came to have to admit in this pursuit and exploring Christianity. She said, we would all like something to hold on to, at least I know I'm looking for something like that. When it comes to religious belief, we all make a choice. That choice might be to ignore the question of religion entirely, which is more than a legitimate response. But perhaps to suggest that we only make one choice is an oversimplification. We are making choices in what we believe and do not believe all the time. We are making choices in what we believe and do not believe all the time. Like, do not pretend, she's saying, like the one choice you make when it comes to religion is whether or not you're going to be religious or not. Like, I will join that religion or not. You are religious. You have a religion based on what you believe will give you the life you're looking for. And Lamorna, my new friend, would say, we are making choices in what we believe and do not believe all the time. She's kind of echoing the ghost of David Foster Wallace, who would say, there is no such thing as atheism. It doesn't exist because everyone worships something. So here's the question that Paul is beginning with. Do you know what you're worshiping and sacrificing for? Do you know how religious you are? Do you know, whether you're aware of it or not, that you have a God and that God has a gospel and you are sacrificing and worshiping in response to that God's gospel to get what that God has promised you? But that's just where Paul starts them. It's not the only thing he wants to do. He's not just trying to expose their religious idolatry and go, hey, do you know how religious you are? All right, I'm out of here. No, he's trying to prime the pump to show them something. He wants to show them about the Jesus that he met. So look at what he does in verse 22 and 23. So Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. Here we go. This is amazing. For I passed along and observed the objects of your worship. As I was walking through the city, I found also an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God. What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you. Okay, here's what he just said. Y'all are so religious, and you so need the promises that these gods have made you in return for your worship and sacrifice, but you still don't have what you're looking for, Bono would say. You still haven't found it. And so here's what you've done, men of Athens. You created a shrine to a god that you don't even know the name of. You just called it to the unknown god. And let's start worshiping and sacrificing to that god. Then maybe that god will make us, sustain us, and make us belong. You're so religious, you're making up unknown gods. But here's how he's turning it. This is so masterful. He says, what you call the unknown god, let me tell you his real name. Like, you've been worshiping this unknown God that no one's ever told you about, and you're so religious, you've been sacrificing and worshiping it. Can I tell you about him? He's using like that segue into, do you know how religious you are? You have an unknown God. He's not unknown to me. Let me tell you his name. He's saying, you're craving so much from your idols. You're demanding so much for them, and I'm here to tell you that they can't give you what you're asking them to give you, but my God can. I want to show you how my God is better than all of your idols. Let me just do this real briefly. This is what Paul rolls out to them when he's saying, hey, you know that unknown God? Let me tell you about him. Here's what he tells them about his God. Verse 24, he starts this way. He is the God who made the world and everything in it, including you. He made you. He created you. You're made in his image. He recreates you. You get your sense of self from him. He has the most secure identity from you because you remain his image, and that can't change. He gave you his image. So you don't need any of these other gods to make you or to create you or to give you an identity. You already have that from this God. He made you. He made the world. And you're part of it. So my God made you, Paul would say. And then verse 28. And he does this a couple different ways. We could have plucked it out from anywhere, but he says in verse 28, in him we live and move and have our being. And in verse 27, he says something to the effect of like, we all get our life and breath from that God, from this God. Here's what he just told them. My God didn't just make you. Do you know you get your very breath from him? Like, do you know how much he sustains you? He's giving you your very life. And this means this, he's there when you need him because he's never left you. He's that close to you. Do you know my God sustains your very life? My God made you. My God sustains you. And then this is what he does in verse 28 and 29. This is masterful. This is like apologetics 101. Literally, like whole courses are written on this from Paul, what he does right here in 28 and 29. Listen to what he says. Verse 28. As even some of your own poets have said. Okay, so he's about to quote a very popular poem from Athens. It'd be like quoting Taylor Swift or something, okay? Although she's not a poet. She's a showgirl this week. It's her new album, whenever it's coming out. So he's quoting a very well-known lyric from one of their very popular poems. And this is what the poem said, not written about the God of Israel, not written about Paul's God, but look at how he twists it. This is the line from the poem, for we are indeed his offspring. That poem was about Zeus, they're king of the gods. But Paul's saying, no, no, no. Do you know how badly you want to belong to Zeus? I'm telling you, you don't belong to Zeus. You belong to my God. Verse 29, he says, being then God's offspring, not Zeus's. You don't belong to Zeus, you belong to my God. Do you know what it means to be God's offspring? It means you belong to him. It means that your maker and your sustainer is also your father. It means you have a family with him. It means you have a table. It means you have a place. It means you have a seat with him. It means with him, you find your sense of belonging because you join his family and where you are not alone. So here's what Paul just did in like five verses. My God made you, my God sustained you, and you belong with my God. You're his child. Here's what Paul just did. Men and women of Athens, what you want your idols to do for you can only truly be found in the God I'm telling you about. It's amazing. And then he goes farther. Look back with me at verse 24 and 25. The God who made the world and everything in it, being the Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man. Like, he's not living in these Parthenons that you built, these shrines that you built. Look at what he says, verse 25. Nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. That little line, as though he needed anything. Here's what Paul just said. The God that made you, sustained you, and gives you a place to belong doesn't need anything from you, which means this. All the gods of your pantheon that you're worshiping and sacrificing to try to get them to be in your debt, that they owe you something now, my God doesn't require that of you because he's not lacking anything. He doesn't need anything. This is not like your gods. He makes you, he sustains you, and he gives you a place to belong, and he doesn't make you earn your way into it or sacrifice your way into it. The Lord doesn't require of you what other idols require of you, because my God doesn't need anything from you. So he makes you, he sustains you, and he gives you a place to belong, and he doesn't charge you anything. He gives it to you. That's who my God is. He's so different from your gods. Do you see, men of Athens? Do you see, women of Athens? He's not like the gods that you've been worshiping. He's remarkably different, and he actually came to give you what you long for from your gods. But then this last thing, this line haunted me this week. But this to me is the sweetest, like if every God has a gospel, Paul's about to put the exclamation point on his God's gospel. Not only does my God make you, sustain you, give you a place to belong, and not only does he not charge you for it, let me tell you about him a little bit more. Look at verse 26 and 27. Verse 26, kind of the setup. It says, and he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place. Verse 27, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him, yet he is actually not far from each one of us. Yet he is actually not far from each one of us. That's what haunted me this week. Let me tell you what Paul just said. The God that you're seeking has actually been seeking for you. And the God that you're seeking, you've named it this unknown God. You don't even know what to call him. I'm telling you, he was seeking you before you even knew who he was. He was seeking you before you decided to seek him. He was coming after you before you decided to come after him. Do you know how remarkably different that framework is than any God they had ever heard of? Please note, he's not talking to Christians on Mars Hill. He's talking to Greek philosophers and religious people. And what does he tell them? My God's not far from any of you. He's been seeking you. Do you want to know proof of how Paul knew that his God was seeking them? Because he was there telling them about him. The God that you're seeking has actually been seeking you. Even if you haven't been aware of it, even if you've been seeking after other gods and sacrificing to them, even if you've been looking for security and identity and a place to belong with all these other gods, this God is not far from you and he doesn't need anything from you. He's never left being close to you. With all of your escapades and all of your worshiping of other gods, all of your abandoning him, even though he made you in his image, He never left seeking you out. Paul is trying to drill it into them that his God's gospel is not like the others. The seeking and the finding order with this God is completely reversed. He is not like the unapproachable gods of Mount Olympus. He is the incarnate God of Calvary. He is the unchanging God who made, sustains, and welcomes you home, and he doesn't charge you for it. And he so didn't need you, he just wants you. So he came looking for you. So here's the invitation. The whole sermon was leading up to this question. Would you let him in? Christian or not, would you let yourself be loved by this God today? Would you submit to his seeking of you? If you've believed in him before and you're going, oh, this is where he's talking to non-Christians in the room, it's not. I'm talking to you. Would you let God make you, remake you, sustain you, and welcome you back to his table, maybe for the millionth time? He has never left being very close to you. He does not need you. He wants you. So would you let him in? Let's pray, and then we'll sing to this Jesus together. Jesus, you are not far from any one of us. And you made us, and you sustain us, and you give us a place to belong, and we have told you explicitly and implicitly that we would rather find those things with other gods. And so forgive us, one, Jesus, forgive our need for relevancy, forgive our need for money, forgive our demand to have our bodies or our jobs or our city tell us who we are. Would you help us to exhale all of the exhaustion that comes from trying to earn what we think we need from these other gods? And do what we began our time singing about, to come and rest in your love for us, for you are not far from each one of us. And through this mystery, Jesus, I can't explain how it all works, but I know you're here. I know your spirit is like the hound of heaven. It's been seeking all of us. And so in this brief time, in these short moments as we close in singing, would you let us have the courage to let you in, to submit to your love for us? We ask all this in your name, Jesus. Amen.